Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryant, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. There are a lot of you out there this week. Thank you for logging on shorter notice. We're not planning to be here next week for the Rosh Hashanah holiday, and we're not going to be here the week after for Yom Kippur, but somewhere in our calculations, we messed up the calendar. But it works to our advantage and to your advantage because we got a terrific guest this week, Dr. Stephen Bryan. We're shifting our focus this week from the Middle East, where we have been for the last 2 years, to China. And it seems to me that the American people and Congress and the president have awakened to some extent to the problem caused by communist China, the trade problems, the problem of China stealing our technology, funding American institutions to the benefit of our technology. Unresolved problems having to do with the origins of COVID, we're still there. And human rights, especially for Uyghurs in Eastern China, and China's support for Russia and North Korea and Iran. We could spend a month on this, but we only have an hour. So we are going to focus today on China's military capabilities and aspirations, as well as American defense capabilities, both in terms of our homeland and in terms of our allies in the Pacific. Who are those allies? What do they bring to the table? What are we all doing out there? But first, your JPC introduction. JPC was founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policy by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. You can sign up there for our insight articles and our magazine In Focus Quarterly. The fall issue of In Focus is under construction. It'll be up shortly. It is entitled Identity, Borders, and Conflict. You can imagine where that goes. You can also find the catalog of, excuse me, JPC webinar programs. They are good for binge watching, glasses of wine, and finding out who we like. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, now more than ever, and missile defense. Right now, as it has been since October 7th, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone and everyone who would deny them, including the UN this week. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in their defense of the borders and the people of Israel, and in bringing the perpetrators of the massacres, rapes, and hostage taking to justice, and making Hamas and its fellow travelers release the hostages. That's all of the hostages, living and no longer living. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. A very hot subject today. And now our guest. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Bryan. And for those of you who asked, yes, he is my husband. And no, that's not why he's here. He's here because he's an expert on security, technology, and strategy. If you read his Substack column, which you should do, you know that he's spent an enormous amount of time studying China and Chinese capabilities, as well as producing a book, Stopping a Taiwan Invasion. Stopping a Taiwan Invasion, which is based on a program he ran with a panel of military and other security experts at the Center for Security Policy. He has help, and it's being published in Korean this week. If you want to try it in Korean, let me know. I'll get you a copy. He has held senior positions on Capitol Hill, in the Defense Department, and is president of a large multinational defense and technology company. He has received the highest civilian awards awarded by the Defense Department on two occasions. Yes, I'm bragging. Yes, I'll stop. And now, Stephen Bryan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. I'm a, I guess a victim is the right word, of the Pentagon, in the sense that if you work in the Pentagon, you can't just talk. You have to talk with the PowerPoint slides. It's impossible for a person in the Pentagon just to talk. It's not allowed either. So in my first experience, I should say something about that quickly, was when I briefed NATO. In those days, we had the slides were on 35 millimeter slides. on a Kodak machine that had a revolving turntable. And as I began my presentation at NATO, the whole thing caught on fire. So it wasn't very good, to say the least. Well, let's start with the slides. What I'm going to try to do today is to, in a very short time, is to show you China's military capabilities, the U.S. military capabilities, the capabilities of its important neighbors, mainly Japan, and Taiwan itself, and then try to summarize the situation as it stands today. And I think everyone knows that the Chinese regard Taiwan as a renegade province, and they have threatened to use force to take it back. So let's go ahead. Next slide, please. There's your Chinese army today. This is a victory parade that was just held in Beijing, with some notable people there, including Vladimir Putin and the North Korean dictator and autocrat Kim Jong-un. Next slide, please. So, first thing to take note of is the fact that the balance of power in the region is shifting. China's military capabilities are growing very fast, an unprecedented rate of growth, meaning that they're in a hurry to demonstrate something. And of course, I think we're on the other end of the stick when we get to the something. The U.S. and its allies therefore face strategic and logistical challenges because we're very far away from China and very far away from Taiwan. This makes it very tricky for us. And as I said, the regional balance is shifting, creating a less favorable environment for the U.S., but also making it harder and harder to maintain deterrence in the region. And if I was to say the primary U.S. goal, it is to maintain deterrence in the Indo-Pacific as a way of preventing any breakout of violence or warfare, and to try and maintain normal relationships with all the players. Next slide, please. Now, China's army, active military army, the number of soldiers is over 2 million people. That's very substantial by any measure. It may even be larger. We don't know for sure, but it's at least 2 million. And these are fighters. These are not just people working in logistics or filling warehouses. These are the people that are on the front lines. The defense budget of China is in excess of 230 billion, and that was in 2024. But actually, it's very much higher. Maybe 470 billion is about right. But they get a lot of bang for their buck. So to a certain extent, they get value for from their budget, something we have a problem with. Now the Navy, it's now Chinese Navy is now the largest Navy by a number of vessels, although not by tonnage and certainly not by the capabilities of the ships. China still has a ways to go, but it's building a blue water Navy for power projection. Next slide, please. The other thing that's going on is they're modernizing all their weapons platforms and expanding their nuclear weapons capabilities. One of the noticeable things, for example, in the People's Liberation Army Air Force is the use of the appearance of more and more fourth and fifth generation stealth fighters like the J-20. And there's two more in the pipeline, two more different types of stealth fighters. There's also a new stealth bomber. It's called the H-20. It's not out there yet, but it will be soon. In terms of the nuclear arsenal, right now there are somewhere around 600 warheads on strategic missiles, and that's projected to more than double by 2035 to about 1,500. For a point of reference, the U.S. has 1,744 active warheads, but not all of them are deployed, and certainly not all the Chinese ones are either. But China does have a complete nuclear triad. The triad is the land, sea, and air-based delivery systems for nuclear weapons, as we do. In fact, we, the Russians and the Chinese, are the three states that really have this capability in the broadest sense of the term. Also, the Chinese are doing more and more with advanced weapons of all kinds. We saw some of that recently in the brief conflict between Pakistan and India, where French airplanes in the Pakistani Air Force were firing Chinese missiles. At least one of them destroyed a major Indian asset aircraft, maybe as many as three. And the other thing I think is very important to point out is that China is very advanced in unmanned aerial vehicles and also unmanned surface vehicles on land and on the sea. So they've got it all, and they dominate the marketplace for these kinds of warheads and weapons. And what we're seeing in Ukraine is the use of a lot of Chinese-made parts in both the Ukrainian drones and the Russian ones. So that they don't care if they supply both sides, they're just supplying whatever is needed. Next slide, please. So let's look at the US. Now, I'm only going to look at the Pacific part of the US deployment, because that's the part that if it gets engaged, is available to fight. There's more, obviously, behind that, but to get it into position and to be able to use it is a big challenge. Right now in the Pacific area, we have about 120,000 active service members and about 40 military sites, including major hubs in Japan, Hawaii, which is very far away, South Korea, which is closer, and Guam, which is also pretty far away. Guam is about 1,740 miles from Taiwan. In terms of operational commands, the U.S. Pacific Fleet runs the world's largest naval command of 200 ships and 1,500 aircraft. That means that we're talking here a lot about the aircraft carriers, which one of which is based, home based, in Japan, and the other one is potentially available, but it's in San Diego. It's far away. The air component is really pretty good on the US side, and mostly with systems like the F-22, which is you probably know is a stealth fighter bomber, and the F-35, which is an air superiority stealth aircraft. And then we have F-16s, F-15s, and other kinds of aircraft. The Marine Corps is also very active. They're primarily there to intervene in case of an attack on Taiwan. They are increasingly better equipped than they were in the past, especially with systems like HIMARS, which is the multi-rocket launcher and with long-range rockets that can be positioned pretty close to Taiwan on some of the islands in near Taiwan. Let's go ahead to the next slide, please. Now, Japan is our most significant ally when it comes to China. I didn't bother giving you a rundown on Korea today because Korea has its own problem with North Korea. And how much of Korea's forces would be available to the US in case of a conflict, I don't know, but not too much. Now, Japan has been, over the years, spending very little on defense. It only recently increased its spending to about 2% of its gross domestic product, which is a target that the US had set for Japan in the past, although now, under the Trump administration, they want to see it more like 3.5%. There's no chance that Japan will reach that level. The main force, the land force that Japan has, is called the Self-Defense Force, the Ground Self-Defense Force. And it's basically a small unit focusing on rapid response and highly mobile capabilities. It's so small that it hardly counts in the equation, although they can cause trouble. Japan does operate a number of Aegis-equipped destroyers, and I'll explain that in a second, and is upgrading its helicopter destroyers to operate F-35 jump jets, fighter jets. The Aegis system is an air defense system. The U.S. Navy has it on its destroyers and on its Ticonderoga-class corvettes. And the Japanese have it on their destroyers. There are about four of them, I think, altogether. It's a pretty good system, but it's a small deployment. Whether it could handle a heavy Chinese operation is something we have to find out. We don't really know. Japan does have a good submarine force. These are attack submarines, does not have missile submarines. And they are conventional. They are diesel electrics with lithium batteries and with hydrogen power packs that extend their range and the time they can spend underwater. And finally, Japan has an air self-defense force, which is aircraft, a mix of F-15Js and DJs, F-2, which is the Japanese version of the F-16, and F-35AB fighter jets. These are conventional, not jump jets. We'll see if Japan actually buys the jump jets. We don't know yet. Okay, next slide, please. Let's talk a little bit about Taiwan. Taiwan has a pretty good sized army between 94,000 and 104,000 soldiers. And it tried to shift to a modern volunteer-based force because the mandatory service before last year was only 4 months for the average Taiwanese. That's been extended to 1 year, which is better, but it's still, they've got a long way to go in keeping a real well-trained army in place. By the way, we provide very minimal training to the Taiwan Army. We now are providing, I think, around 200 trainers that have gone there under the Trump administration. Before that, there were hardly any. The defense budget in Taiwan is about $20.2 billion, which is a good number if it's spent wisely. They are modernizing their F-16s to what we call the F-16V or Viper jet status with new radars, new bombing capabilities, all kinds of new stuff, making it a far better airplane. And they're also buying new ones. They haven't shown up yet, but they should be soon. I think their strategy is to develop smaller, faster, and heavily armed vessels like the Zhoushan class corvettes to enable them to do a porcupine strategy. And I'll come to that in just a second. They also have an indigenous submarine program. They've already built one submarine, but it's not commissioned yet. And I don't know, I can't tell you whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. They got a lot of help from the US and under the table help from European countries, especially Germany and Sweden. But let's say the performance rated related aspects of these submarines isn't known. Eventually they'll build four. Right now, the Taiwan submarine forces only got two mid-1980s Dutch submarines, one of which is being refurbished and the other will be. And two Guppy class midget small submarines, I don't call them midget, but small submarines from the World War II arsenal of the US, which are useless as practical matter. Next slide, please. So about the porcupine strategy. Basically, the idea is for Taiwan to be able to fight against much larger, superior Chinese forces, to try and tie them down. And obviously to wait for help mainly from the United States. We expected a Chinese invasion of Taiwan would be based on, from what we see on the naval exercises, includes a blockade of the island, requiring Taiwan to acquire and maintain a supply of weapons and ammunition so they can wage a land-based war inside Taiwan if the Chinese are successful in getting into the island. And they have different strategies where they could do that. Next slide, please. Now, as I mentioned earlier, China considers Taiwan a renegade province. China has never renounced the use of force, although they have indicated that they are willing to potentially consider a negotiated outcome between Taiwan and China. It hasn't happened, of course. The U.S. does not have formal diplomatic relations or even a defense treaty with Taiwan. And this creates a significant problem. And I'll come to that in just a minute. So the U.S. support for Taiwan is based primarily on the congressionally passed, in 1979, Taiwan Relations Act, which allows for the sale of defense equipment, but does not oblige the U.S. to intervene militarily. So whether the U.S. would come to Taiwan's rescue is an open question. It's undecided, and there are no written agreements of any kind that would oblige the U.S. to do so. And in recent last few years, and even as recently as yesterday, China has been dramatically increasing military incursions across the median line of the Taiwan Strait. It's median line dividing the Taiwan Straits onto a Chinese side and a Taiwan side, sort of a agreed approach by both Taiwan and China. The Chinese have been systematically violating that arrangement. And the difficulty here is that every time they cross, the Taiwanese have to launch aircraft to challenge them. And one of these days, sooner or later, we could get into trouble and it could start a conflict. So that's something to bear in mind. So far, we've been fairly lucky. The Chinese know when to leave. The Taiwanese know when not to shoot. If things continue to deteriorate, I don't see how you can depend on that arrangement. Next slide, please. Now, one of the other areas that's very interesting, and another point of conflict between China and this time Japan, are the Senkaku Islands. I'm going to show you a map of them in a minute. Basically, the Chinese have been trying to claim these islands as their own, although they're under Japanese administration, have been since the 1960s, I think. And this situation could lead to trouble. Most of these islands are not inhabited, but a few are, and there is an airfield on one of them. And the U.S. Marines have been in and out of one of these islands, probably to, which is very close to Taiwan, probably trying to figure out how we could use systems like HIMARS to defend Taiwan by stopping an invasion fleet. The problem is we don't have enough HIMARS, and they will be vulnerable to Chinese missiles. So I think we have a place where there could be trouble. The Chinese claims are not completely off the wall. Nor, by the way, the Taiwanese also claim these islands. So it's not just Taiwan. China is Taiwan too. And it's a problem going forward. Now, the U.S. has agreed with Japan that the mutual defense treaty, which we have with Japan, now includes the Senkaku Islands. So if something happens there, the U.S. would be obliged to intervene on behalf of Japan if asked. So that's the story, and this is another boiling point. There's nothing of any great value on these islands except rare earth materials, which have not been, mostly those are offshore, and they have not been exploited. So it's still early to say how important they are, but the Japanese see it as a very important. The next slide, please. Just to show you where Taiwan is. There's Japan. You can see the island chain, and Ishigaki, which is about 70 kilometers. I'm sorry, from Taipei, which is pretty close. Recently being like about 3 years ago, the Japanese emperor and his wife visited this island so they could show the support for Taiwan, waving to the Taiwanese people standing on a hill. Whether that's meaningful to you or me, I don't know, but that's what they did. It was interesting. Next slide, please. So, what are the problems for us? We have a bunch of them. First, the number of U.S. soldiers and naval officers and airmen deployed in the Pacific is very small compared to Chinese forces. So, in any conflict, the U.S. will have to bring additional forces from Hawaii or from the mainland of the United States, probably mostly from San Diego. And that will have to be done. There's no other way because there just aren't enough men there to do the job, men and women there to do the job. It's also a logistics problem because it's so far away. And aircraft carriers, which we have depended on. I was in Taiwan in 1996 when the Chinese were fixing to invade the island, and we moved, finally moved. That was under U.S. president. We finally moved after a couple of weeks of begging two aircraft carriers into the space, which told the Chinese there was no free lunch here, and they backed off. And since then, and that was under Clinton, just in case you're wondering. And since then, the Chinese have been working very hard to push our aircraft carriers back as far as possible. And these hypersonic missiles that you hear a lot about were essentially anti-ship missiles designed to destroy U.S. aircraft carriers. And if you can push them all the way back to Guam, you're 1,240 miles from Taiwan. It's very far. There also are political constraints. The biggest one may not hit you in the face right away, but it's there, is whether China, whether, I'm sorry, whether Japan will be a good partner, a good ally, and help if Taiwan is attacked. They say they will, but it's not so clear that they will. The real issue has to do with the number of bases we have in Japan, plus Okinawa, which are controlled by Japan. If Japan says we can't use them, we can't use them. And that would essentially lock us out of any way to help the Taiwanese. Moreover, the U.S. doesn't have any military bases in Taiwan, whatever. We used to, but when we de-recognized Taiwan, we also liquidated our military bases, especially very large marine bases that were on the island. They were all gone. The next point is, I think, a very significant one, and that is the U.S. might try to head off a conflict, or if the conflict starts, still to try and intervene using diplomacy instead of military force. And I think that's a very likely potential. Whether the Chinese will pay any attention to that, I don't know. It depends on the deal they might get. They get a good enough deal, they might do that, but it's not very good news for Taiwan. And at the end of the day, it's not very good news for the United States. Finally, a few points. The first one is that our stockpiles of weapons are quite low right now. The Ukraine war has sucked up an awful lot of ammunition and an awful lot of missiles that have been deployed to Ukraine for the Ukrainian forces, which takes them out of U.S. weapons stockpiles. And it takes time, sometimes many years, to replace them. The other is that air defenses for all three parties, the US, Taiwan, and Japan, are relatively limited. The US really, its air defenses are based on the Aegis destroyers and cruisers that we have in the region. And they're very good, but they have to be moved into the right place. And whether they could do very much on their own by themselves is not so clear. Taiwan has the Patriot system from the United States, which has shown itself to be relatively good. But when you're facing a ballistic missile threat, as Taiwan is, and that's one of the big threats the Chinese are leveraging Taiwan, whether you can really stop enough of those missiles to make a difference is an open question. Japan also uses its destroyers for Aegis, but it does have Patriot, But Patriot is more of a point defense system. It doesn't have any strategic defenses beyond that on the Japanese islands. There was an effort to do it, but the Japanese rejected it and walked it back. So I would say that right now, the overall correlation of forces does not favor a U.S. military response, but it more or less favors some kind of diplomatic response. Now, the sore point here, just to sum up and conclude, the sore point is what happened in Hong Kong. The Taiwanese were relatively interested in the possibility of a negotiated deal until the Chinese essentially took Hong Kong away from the British and promised all sorts of things which they didn't deliver, and essentially took away their independence and their local political processes. And I think the Taiwanese are afraid that that's what's going to happen to them. And the Chinese have not made any bones about it. They've made it clear that they're one of the targets they have are the political leadership of Taiwan. And that's a message that the political leadership of Taiwan has to live with. So I'll stop there. That gives you a kind of a snapshot. Hope it's helpful. And I'll be happy to take questions.
Yes, it's helpful. And it also raises a lot of questions. So let's start with a broad question, just to say there's a theory in Washington now, I think specifically in the Trump administration, that says there are three parts of the world. There is Europe, there's the Middle East, and there's Asia. And that the Europeans should be taking care of Europe, that NATO is lacking in its determination to defend itself, and they're relying on us. And the Middle East should be taken care of sort of by Israel, but also sort of by Saudi Arabia. And our priority has to be Asia, that we should be moving, I don't want to say our military, but our interests, at least our focus, at least from those other two places to Asia. So my first question would be, what do you think of that theory? And then, why is Taiwan so important anyway? I mean, it raises the question. It's an island. It's got a lot of people. It makes computer chips. But why is Taiwan important?
Okay, let's go first with
Unpack.
try to answer that one or those questions because there's more than one there.
Yes.
The U.S. started officially to pivot toward China, maybe as far back as Brzezinski, but certainly during the administration of. In Washington, that prior to the current one, the Biden administration, that thought that that's where we should put our effort. I think initially they weren't really expecting Ukraine to suck down so much of our capabilities. In fact, I know they didn't expect it. We spent close to $200 billion in weapons for Ukraine. And there's not new weapons. These are weapons, most of them come out of our inventory. So we've robbed Peter to pay Paul, I guess, but that makes trying to pivot to the Pacific more and more difficult. The other thing that's not as obvious but is significant is a lot of our air fleet, especially those F-16s and F-15s, are worn out. So they're still usable, but they're worn out. And there's a question of whether we should continue to invest in them and keep them flying or whether we should buy new airplanes. But buying new airplanes takes years. You don't get them that fast. And we are building F-35s. So they will play an important role. But having enough of them to matter, I don't know yet. That's an interesting question. Now, why does it matter? Taiwan sits right in the middle of what's called the first island chain. This is a chain of islands running from northern Japan all the way down. And Taiwan is the pivot. It's the crucial strategic place because of the Strait, Taiwan Straits, and because of passageways from China out to the Blue Water Sea. If we let's say if Taiwan became part of China, they will do a number of things. They'll put major naval bases on Taiwan for sure. They'll put missile bases on Taiwan for sure. They'll bring their air force to Taiwan. And that threatens not only Japan, which would certainly be threatened because it's right next door. You saw the map I showed earlier. But it also threatens, other places like the Philippines, where there's already trouble with the Chinese and Indonesia and other countries in the region. But most of all, it pushes us back further from being able to play a creative and role in balancing the power of China, which is going to become increasingly difficult over time.
Okay, so this leads to another question.
I
You
knew that was
mentioned,
going to happen.
if it didn't happen, I wouldn't have a job.
No.
You mentioned that China has 2 million soldiers, and that's people under arms. That's not the logistical one behind the forces.
Well, as we, we're a little limited, but that's what we think.
Okay, so let's take that as a. Now, it raises a couple questions. First is the demographic question. We understand that China is aging rapidly. The one-child policy did not work out quite the way they thought it would. And they are expecting a very, very steep decline in China's population. But before they get to that, a lot of people are going to age out of the military. So are we facing a temporary problem, a medium-term problem, a long-term? How does the demographic issue play out in terms of size and shape? Or are the Chinese moving toward more technology and fewer troops on the ground?
Well, the last point you made is quite valid. They're moving toward artificial intelligence, robotics, unmanned vehicles, all kinds of systems that require much fewer people to run. So they're definitely doing that. There's a crisis across Asia about population. It's not just in China. Japan has a huge problem because the girls don't want to get married and they don't want to have babies. The same
Wow.
thing. The same thing is going on in Korea. And there's going to be a fallout, a fall off and fall out from that problem over time. But you're talking the decade or more. So I don't
Right.
think it impacts anything right now, but in the future it does. But I also think China's very smart. They realize that the more there's two reasons why you do a lot of automation. One is it's much better than not doing automation. You get a lot of value from it in military terms. And the second is artificial intelligence machines don't mutiny. They don't get killed and they don't mutiny. So it's very attractive. The Chinese have done a lot of purges of military officers, including its missile forces, in the last let's say 3 to 4 years. And it's very hard to understand what's going on. But I think it's Xi trying to consolidate his power and to prevent a coup. And that's what's happening. So moving to more and more automation serves their interests very much. And so I think that's where they're going.
So I don't think we even think about this. I mean, we know that there's Chinese repression. We know that they do surveillance of their own people. But I think most of us, at least I do, had thought of the military as loyal to the government, including loyal to Xi. But perhaps he doesn't feel that way.
Well, he's sacking them, so a
So I
lot
guess he doesn't.
of them.
Okay.
I saw one report that said that as many as 30,000 may have been disciplined under the Xi
Wow.
regime, which is a big number, and maybe 400 have been, accused of various crimes like corruption, including some very, very high-ranking people. And it hasn't stopped there. It's also included people in the civilian establishment. For example, Qin Gang, who was their foreign minister, was sacked in 2023. Not because he performed badly, because he was considered by Xi as a threat to his leadership. There's one, I think there's something very interesting. If you watch the victory parade that just took place in Beijing a week before last, which was quite spectacular in many ways, they sort of copy the Russian style. And the North Koreans also copy the Russian style of parade, almost down to every detail, including the women troops and the cheering and the whole thing. What really caught my attention was something a little unusual. Typically, if you watch a Russian military parade, there's the leadership of the state, which stands usually away from the parade, watching the parade, and the soldiers come in front of them to show their support, hoorah, hoorah, and all that sort of thing. In the case, and there was some of that in the Chinese parade, but there was one thing totally different. Instead of the defense minister or the commander in chief of the armed forces driving around the troops in an open car, calling on them to cheer, it was Xi. Here's Xi. What's he doing there? Well, I
So
think he's just
she's in the car.
he's in the car standing up. There's a microphone, there's a
Wow.
thing to hold on to, and he's leading the show. Now, why him? Why is he doing that? I think he was doing that to make a point. I'm in charge. No one else. I'm in charge. Here I am. I'm in charge. Last time someone tried that was Sadat, and he got shot. But in any case,
Yes.
do you remember that?
I
Was
do.
it 1984? Something like that.
Yes, like that.
Yeah. Anyhow, it was very interesting to me, and it said that this is a very nervous regime.
So she is nervous. We're not exactly calm here. But the map that you showed us of the Pacific, you also mentioned the first island chain, and that it goes all the way down and it affects a bunch of other countries, Indonesia, the Philippines, Malaysia, New Zealand, and Australia. But
Singapore, very important.
Singapore, right? And we don't think of Singapore in terms of countries because it's not very big, but it is a very wealthy
It's a
place and a very
city. It's a
important place.
city state, but
City state, very
it has
important
a
place.
decent
Now,
sized military.
so if you look at them, where did they fit in terms of being our allies? Worried about China, worried about, I mean, one of the things I used to have a map that showed the oil imports from the Persian Gulf and how they would go around China. And if China controlled the island chain, all of those countries would have their oil imports from the Middle East disturbed. China would say they were doing it to protect themselves. Are these our allies? Do they work with us, train with us,
Well,
do
they
war
do.
games? Where
They
are they?
do. We don't have defense treaties with them, but we have agreements of different kinds, especially with the Philippines in recent years, and with Singapore too. I'm not as sure about Indonesia, but probably yes. And we do exercises, military exercises with them, and we sell them weapons. We train them. So we do a lot of things with them. We don't have an obligatory treaty with any of them that says we will come to their defense. Only with Japan and Korea do we have that kind of arrangement.
So, what about Australia and New Zealand? I mean, we have
Well, we do, but that's so
clearly
far.
we have.
I think Australia is so far away as to be kind of a secondary location at best.
Okay.
So I hadn't considered it, but yeah, it's true. And the Chinese are creeping up on Australia too, by the way.
Okay, so
Vanuatu, is that what it's called?
what?
I'm not sure.
Creepy?
Creeping up on them, with the Chinese and the Korean, the Australians are competing over. I think it's called Vanuatu, but I may be wrong about the pronunciation. This little place where the Chinese are trying to establish a foothold, very
But
close
they
to.
are establishing. In fact, Vanuatu was one of those Pacific islands that was very, very pro-Israel in the UN and elsewhere. And after China began to work with them or be interested in them or any way you want to put it,
Guess
they've
it. Money.
changed their attitude big time. Vanuatu has. So,
China has a lot of money,
they
and they
do
don't
have.
mind using it either. I mean,
Oh, and
the subversion of these places is something we have to watch very carefully, not just down there, but all along the There's going to be a lot of it,
Which
especially as their military power continues to increase, then they feel more confident that they can threaten the United States. I think that's the key situation here. And it depends on whether the United States wants to play. I mean, there's nothing that requires us to play, actually, except for Japan and Korea.
So we could just say no, we're not. I mean,
We,
theoretically,
yes,
theoretically.
yeah, we can say no.
Okay. It's
I mean,
important to understand.
yeah, I mean, we're not under any obligation to defend Taiwan. Let's face it, there's no agreements. The one thing that Taiwan, we sell arms to Taiwan thanks to the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, passed by Congress over the objections of the administration at the time that didn't want it. But without the Taiwan Relations Act, Taiwan wouldn't even get U.S. weapons or technology.
I think that's a huge point. I think a lot of people miss that, when we talk about Taiwan. So thank you for stressing that point. I think it's not well understood. You mentioned money. Everybody mentions money about everything because money is the linchpin of everything.
It helps.
So a listener points out that the Chinese defense budget is one thing, it's a number, but its purchasing power in China is significantly higher than the purchasing power of an equivalent amount of money, let's say here. Because when we go after weapons and technology and we buy from American defense producers, we're spending more. Our troops cost more. Paying them, feeding them, everything about them costs more. So when you talk about their budget, it's really a lot different than ours because it does differ, it does a lot more things for them.
Well, there's even more to it than that. And I agree with you. You're absolutely right. But the other part is that the Chinese defense budget takes advantage of the fact that they steal our technology in big amounts, both commercial, quote unquote, commercial, and military. They've penetrated everything. And stupid American companies like Microsoft, who works for the Pentagon by putting up a cloud computer system, has the Chinese supervising it. It's complete insanity. Complete insanity. And they don't care. It's cheaper to use Chinese labor than American labor, I guess.
Talk about this because I seem to recall at one point the administration, the prior Trump administration, seemed to see this as a as an issue and banned the use the purchase of Chinese-made computers into the Pentagon, but we're still running
Not
Chinese.
really. Not
Now
really.
they okay, so talk about this because I thought that was a good move at the time, but if it's not carried through, and if you're using, even if you're not using Chinese computers, but you're using Chinese supervision and the cloud services, why are we doing that?
Well, we don't have much choice. I mean, if you want to buy a computer today, or any other gadget, the Internet of Things comes to mind. Probably made in China. Taiwan does produce computers, laptops,
Yes.
not bigger ones. But when you get to the specialized boards and all these things that go into weapons, you probably have to buy them from China. We're very vulnerable to that.
So one of our listeners sent in a question. Actually, I'll get to that in a second. You mentioned, now we're going to get there. You mentioned China steals. I think everybody knows China steals. It's not a
Yeah, but
secret.
I think the implications are that this frees up a big piece of their defense budget to spend on things they can't steal.
Right.
Okay.
And it raises the question of Chinese students in the United States. We have thousands of them. We have tens of thousands of Chinese students in the United States. China is funding American universities big time, sending lots of students here. Are they a net plus, those students, or are they a net negative? Are they going home with stuff they
The
otherwise wouldn't
old
have?
liberal the old liberal theory was that you bring these students here, they learn the American way, they become excited about American democracy, they take it back to China, and they make change in China. Complete nonsense. But that was the theory. What they do is they make friends with professors. They learn about their research. They let the Chinese authorities know what's going on. They are tasked by the Chinese authorities to do certain things, which they do very religiously. Otherwise, they get sent home. So they have not much freedom, and their families are hostage anyway. So it's a very lucrative operation for the Chinese. They pay the tuition costs, but they get so much back in terms of defense technology and civilian technology that they need that it's, well, we'll give you one great example is the whole heist of nanotechnology from Harvard University, which is very well documented because finally the American professor who ran it got indicted. But it was loaded with Chinese students and Chinese researchers, Chinese money, because nanotechnology is very, very important for all sorts of military and civilian applications. So Harvard contributed mightily to China's development. And this happens every day, not just Harvard. Every major research institution, probably in the United States, in one way or another, is being ripped off.
Okay, so this does go to that question that the listener sent in. And that is, what are the top four things the Trump administration could focus on that might make a difference in this? Would students be one of them?
Sure. And professors. Because they also run, China runs programs to bring American professors to China. To give lectures, but what they're really doing is sucking them dry, and learning a whole lot, and then they get to learn all the players. And once they know all the players, they can either hack them or, give them money or whatever they decide to do, and they do it systematically, based on what their agenda, whatever their agenda happens to be, with the technology. I'll give you another example, scramjet. You know what a scramjet is? The
Give
scramjet,
us a short,
huh?
give us a short
It's a
answer.
very, it's a small, very powerful engine that allows, let's say, a missile to fly at hypersonic speeds. But because it's going so fast and it runs at such very high temperatures, it needs all kinds of special materials to construct. NASA ran a very important program for many years working on what are called ceramics for that application. And of course, they invited the Chinese and the Russians to come and join them.
So we never did this with the
So,
Russians. We never treated the Russians at the same time as if they were a potential problem for us, which the Russians always were, and we knew that, but also a potential, I don't want to say friend, but somebody we could work with. So how can we do this for China?
well, I'm not sure about friend or foe or whatever you want to call it.
I'm not either.
These are potential adversaries, and maybe not even potential is a good enough term anymore. And we haven't tightened up our oversight of critical technologies that are vital to the American economy and to the American military. It's laissez-faire all the way down, and liberal sentiments, all of which the Chinese are exploiting up to their armpits. They know what to do. We don't know what to do.
Okay, so Chinese, we need four things. Four things. The one is,
Oh, I thought that was
well,
one thing.
okay,
That
so
was a
that's
good
a
one,
good
I
one.
thought.
Right.
One is the universities and the research institutions. Okay. Second one is export controls, which were screwed up royally. We just allowed NVIDIA, which is our number one artificial intelligence company, to export its best products to China. What?
Right.
That's where the competition for the future is. So NVIDIA wants the business, and Trump administration agreed that NVIDIA should get the business. What it means as a practical matter is that we've lost any leverage over artificial intelligence for the future. Very, very dangerous. That's number two. Number three, I think is our, we have to improve our posture in the Pacific if we want to be serious. which means we need more weapons, more air defenses. We need a much better relationship with Taiwan than we've got, because if we're called upon to defend Taiwan, how can we do it when we'll have no relations with Taiwan, where our military guys barely have any contacts? How do you deconflict their airplanes and our airplanes and Chinese airplane, all that? You can't without practicing it extensively. And the Chinese, sorry, the Taiwanese are always excluded from U.S. exercises in the region. That should stop. They should be included in all the exercises. It'll make the Chinese very mad, but that's okay. I mean, the other choice is to leave them so vulnerable and leave ourselves so vulnerable, because you can only help if you can help. And if you have no communications, you have no coordination, you have no understanding of what you'll do and what they'll do and where and how command and control is going to work, all of that is absent, not there. Making almost lunacy out of the idea of coming to Taiwan's defense.
Okay, so this goes to a point someone just sent in because we'll get to your fourth thing in a
I
minute.
remember it, yeah.
All right, whatever. Yeah, deconfliction with Taiwan, and they're kind of out there by themselves, and we're not, you know. But he asks the question, do we want to defend Taiwan more than the Taiwanese want to defend it themselves? Why would we put our troops into a Taiwan conflict? Okay, I think he's talking, first of all, about 4 months of mandatory military service.
Well, it's
When
a
we
year
did
now.
it, okay, it's a year. So in Israel, it's 3 years. In the US, when we had a draft, it was more than a year. And never was it 4 months. So
No.
have they been lax in their own defense, perhaps thinking that we would save them? I don't know. But he's asking a question, are
That's a
we at
good
war
question.
in
No, it's a
this?
very fair question. And it's a
I
very
think
important
so.
question. And I'll give you my take on it, but that's only my take on it. Taiwan has had trouble recruiting people to the military. Why? Because the military, when Chiang Kai-shek came over with the nationalist troops, was it 49, to Taiwan, they ran a suppression operation using the army they brought, the nationalist army they brought over from China. And that continued with martial law for a long time until the late 1980s. So there's no love lost between the average Taiwanese and the army because of how it was
Good
used
point.
in the past.
Okay. It's a good point.
So recruiting has been very difficult. So that's part of it. But that's the other is that it's a very old-fashioned Chinese army. What do I mean by that? Rigid, not with it, not respecting the new age kind of people who know technology, who can help them. It's very hard to get through their thick skulls to allow new people to really take over the army. And
Generational change.
generational. And of course, it's an army with no experience. The last time there was any armed conflict, I think, was 1958, when the Chinese shelled Quemoy and Matsu. That's what it was called then. It's really Kinmen and Matsu. And the Taiwanese answered them with their shelling. But that was it. I mean, there was one attempted Chinese invasion of Kinmen, Quemoy, around the same period. It failed. It was stupid. And the Chinese learned some lessons. But both the Chinese army and the Taiwanese army are basically inexperienced. They have very little knowledge of modern warfare. The only exception to that is the Air Force, I think, because I think the Air Force is modern and it has modern aircraft and it knows how to use them.
And modern brains, perhaps. Okay, so
Now, pilots are special people.
they are indeed.
Yeah.
Says a man who used to have a pilot's license. So
Still
we've
does.
come
I
up
know you
to.
keep it for life, but it's not, you have to exercise it.
Okay, so we've come to 1 o'clock. We're going to end the program. So you have two choices. You can either find us a fourth thing that the administration should do right away, or you can leave us on an optimistic note as we go out, because one of those two things has to happen.
Well, the fourth thing is to, which is very important, so I'm going to stress it, is that we need to set up a common command between the US, Japan, and Taiwan. And we can do it under the table, top of the table. You know, we can lie about it and say we never did it, but we got to have it, because if we're going to play a role and help them in any situation, we have to be able to coordinate and we have to have command and control. So that, I think, is that's optimistic in the sense that we can do it with some creativity. And I think it's very important for Taiwan, and it's very important for the United States.
And I'm going to stop there and say, I think we've learned really an awful lot in this hour about something that we see periodically in the news, but I don't think we pay enough attention to. So, Stephen Bryan, thank you for bringing us the information. Thank you for putting it in a context that we can think about and use, and ending on a reasonably optimistic note, not too bad. To our listeners, let me wish you a Shana Tova. Gmar Chatima Tova. We will be back. Check your emails and we will be back. And I hope to see you then. Thank you.